Hi, this is Robert Shearer with another edition of Shearer Intelligence, where the intelligence goes to my guest. In this case, arguably one of the most intelligent foreign correspondents, international reporter, Patrick Colburn, a legendary journalist for The Independent and now the I publication based in London. But I watched him work in the field and close to our subject today about Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine and where is this headed now. We were in Moscow and I watched him work when Gorbachev was in power and trying to institute perestroika and glasnost, accuracy, truth, whatever. And so let us, you know, kind of give me the broad picture of how you assess where we are, how we got here, what it's all about. And I want to say I enjoy doing these podcasts because I can learn a lot. And I actually do not know what your answer will be, roughly. I do not. I know it'll be informed. But I just felt the need to call you up, Patrick Colburn, and ask you, what do you think is going on and where is it headed? Okay. And honestly, to people listening, I really don't know what you're going to say. So take it away.
This has turned out to be a much more crucial war, much more decisive in world affairs than people imagined, I think, on the 24th of February when Putin first invaded Ukraine. It's obvious that he's lost the war in Ukraine if his war aim was to take over Ukraine and have a pro-Russian government there. That's lost. One could say it was sort of lost in the first few days when they discovered that the Ukrainians were going to resist, that it wasn't going to be a walkover. But since then, the outcome of the war has become even more serious because it's not just what happens to Ukraine, but what will happen to Russia. Will Russia remain a significant power? Will Putin remain in power? But actually, I think the first question is more important. It was always said in the past, you know, that became something of a cliche to say that Russia without control of Ukraine would cease to be a really serious player. So I guess we're now on the verge of entering a third phase in the Ukraine war. The first one was when the Russians invaded from all quarters. The army offensive broken up, inadequate everywhere, and there was resistance. But also it was a very sort of strange invasion that they didn't, it didn't seem to be sort of properly organized. You know, I've seen the US invade Iraq. I've seen, the Syrian army supposedly with lots of Russian advisors operating in Syria, invasions in Afghanistan. You know, this seemed sort of a sort of half invasion from the beginning. They didn't try to destroy the infrastructure like the US did in Iraq in 1990 by destroying the power lines and the oil refineries. It seemed to be a mess. Then they reorganize things and start an offensive in the Donbass. That again doesn't seem to be going too well. And it seemed to be sort of completely lack any element of surprise that it was on the headlines everywhere. They were going to do this. They are doing this. They're sort of grinding forward. I guess they're getting somewhere, but very, very, very slowly. It seems to me we're now at a decisive moment that will there be a third phase when the Russians mobilize their forces? They've never had a national mobilization, and after all, for a long time. And this was just Putin's special military operation. It wasn't a war. And this is more than a matter of rhetoric. They didn't sort of mobilize what resources they've got. Their great military weakness is sort of lack of infantry. You can see that. They don't have the infantry to defend the tanks. They don't have the infantry to surround cities. So will there be a third round which they declare national mobilization, martial law within Russia? reorientate industrial production to produce weapons, which they could do, quite likely they will do, because not just the future of the regime, but the future of Russia is on the line now.
Let's cut to the chase here. Was Putin provoked, or was he excessively aggressive and ambitious and imperialist to think that they would just crumble? And is it going to be over for Russia and for Putin, or can they resist? Do they have the means? You're quite familiar with that situation. How do you assess it?
Well, there's no doubt that they had genuine grievances that the NATO, the US, had been increasing their influence in Ukraine, particularly since 2014, and were continuing to do so. Putin appears to have thought the time was running out for any military solution that he might try and launch, which is why he did it now. But there were genuine grievances, but not ones to justify an invasion, to my mind. And also, you know, an extraordinary invasion was almost everything which he seems to have believed on before it was launched was untrue, that there would be no resistance from the Ukrainian army, that the Zelensky government could be easily toppled, that the Russians army would just sort of sweep in from all sides, that there wouldn't be much reaction from Western Europe, that they'd be divided, that sanctions would be sort of easily avoidable. And he seems to have been in this sort of fantasy world. And you can see that from the fact that they didn't even withdraw their, you know, they built up this, what was it, $600 billion reserve, financial reserve, and left much of it accessible to the West to freeze it. I mean, they didn't even bring that under control, bring it under their own control. So a complete sort of, I don't think there have been very few invasions in history which have been based on so many misconceptions as this one. Why did Putin do it? Well, 22 years in power, you know, always pretty arrogant, surrounded by sort of advisors who are his sort of old gang from the FSB and before that the KGB, Russian Intelligence Services. Even so, you know, a very, very stupid thing to do.
So do you think what I'm worried about more than anything else is the possibility of nuclear war fighting here. And I don't think Putin is going to go quietly into the night or easily be let out in handcuffs or what have you. And I have no way of assessing the support he has or still has in Russia. There is a Russian nationalism that does back him. How do you see this playing out? I think it's an incredibly risky situation.
Well, there are really two questions there. I mean, one, let's take the nuclear threat first. That I find it one of the most amazing things about this amazing war is that it's not taken more seriously. You know, in the 50s and 60s, people were really worried about a nuclear war, a nuclear exchange. This time around, the likelihood is actually much higher. But nobody, you know, you don't see any demonstrations about it. People don't even seem particularly worried about it. And you see the same people who say Putin is a mad dictator, he's power has gone to his head, he's completely crazed. And then you say, well, hold on a minute, but he's got nuclear weapons. What if this crazed guy might decide to use them? And then they say, I think, in that case, he would behave rather reasonably and can see that was not in his interest to do so. I can't, you can have one or the other, but you can't have both these arguments. But people do. And you see the most sort of you know, dove-like liberals now sort of advocating basically overthrowing Putin. And if that's the objective and the overthrow of the Russian state, sure, people don't have nuclear weapons just to keep in their arsenals. And, you know, there'll be a lot of saber rattling. But, you know, saber rattling runs out of, you know, runs out of steam. It runs out of effectiveness until you actually use the saber, or in this case, you know, nuclear weapons. So I find it pretty amazing that people shouldn't be more worried about that. Now, there was a second question.
Well, let's talk about the first a little bit here, because this is what has startled me about the whole discussion. There's almost a giddiness about the nuclear. Oh, of course, he's not going to use it. There is even a sense that even if he does, it's not the end of the world or anything rhetorically. There's just a lack of seriousness of discussion of this risk. And it's generally put into, oh, it would only be used to scare us, but he wouldn't use it. Well, there's been a lot of talk in our own society as well as theirs. Why do you have weapons if you can never use them? And it may turn out that's the only effective way he has of trying to preserve some of his power. It would be self-defeating, of course. But you know, you've covered this for a long time. How did we get to this point where we're indifferent to it now, the nuclear threat?
Well, first of all, I find it, you know, like you, I find it very strange and alarming, mysterious and alarming that people aren't more worried about this. You know, and we've seen, you know, this has been a gradual process that people have seen arms limitation agreements discarded or simply have not been renewed. And, you know, they've hardly made the front pages. When these were first agreed, you know, they were sort of topping the news. But somehow people, you know, it's as if the limitations on missiles and was irrelevant, belonged to a previous era. So I think people just didn't think about it. And because it hasn't happened before for a long time, they felt that it wouldn't happen now. And it was out of mind. But, you know, it's still pretty extraordinary because, you know, it seems very clear to me that if Putin and the regime are in genuine difficulty, they think they might go, then sure, you know, they're only threatened to use these. But once you make a threat, you know, to make that threat effective, you have to really, in part of your mind, be willing to follow through on the threat. You know, just like I think the one thing that happened with the original land invasion in February, the Russian land invasion of Ukraine, was that Putin felt, you know, that his the saber rattling wasn't getting him anywhere. It seemed to me it was actually getting him places, but somehow he didn't see that. So I think once they start threatening to use nuclear weapons, this is being dismissed, and it's almost an act of treachery to say, well, he means it, because we do, oh, well, you're giving in to Putin's threats, you know, but these are very real. But, you know, you used to have a great sort of CND campaign for nuclear disarmament. You know, similarly in the US, people were, you know, very conscious of Dr. Strangelove situations, and that seems to have disappeared.
Well, even in Germany, where there was such a strong resistance to the concern about the threat of nuclear war, now they're increasing their military spending, and you have this, you know, U.S. flooding in, what, now $35 billion more dollars of weapons, and the Democrats want to increase it by another $8 billion, talking about a land lease program like in World War II, when the Russians actually were doing much of the fighting, and then we supported with Lend-Lease. Now, I guess that's the model, get the Ukrainians to do the fighting, but support it with a lot of weapons, and then ultimately put troops in. But, you know, the Russians have tested now, according to the reports, this week in Odessa, and they did it earlier in the region right up next to Poland, their new missile delivery system, which evidently can't be stopped. It's been conceded, and they've blown up things with it, and those can be armed with a nuclear warhead. And then there can be the illusion the damage will be limited. That's always been the theory of nuclear war fighting, that it doesn't have to be all out. But anyone who's studied it seriously knows that you would not restrict it. The damage would be so awesome and compelling that you would have to write and you react, and you would react, you know, in the use them or lose them fashion. So, I mean, you're a journalist. You're out there. You talk to people. And we don't, you know, you mentioned we don't even have a peace movement. There's no real force of anyone anywhere in the world saying stop, right? Negotiate.
Yeah, and you see that, you know, there's lack of pressure at any level for diplomatic solution. Now, you know, it's reasonable enough to say Putin won't accept that at the moment because he's made no gains and had many losses. But, you know, you sense that there'll almost be disappointment if Russia did go for a diplomatic solution, did accept, did make concessions, and so forth. The comparison here is between the atmosphere in 1914 at the beginning of the First World War and now. You know, that the German invasion of Belgium, various atrocities committed by German troops, a great sort of wave of hostility to Germany and patriotism, a sort of turned almost all the political parties who'd been previously anti-war into advocates of fighting Germany to the finish. I think, you know, it's quite a real comparison. And in both cases, you have this wave of popular hysteria, you know, based on real atrocities. I'm not denying that for a second. But there's a lack of restraint or a lack of foresight of seeing what might happen down the road, and a lack of policy objectives. What is the real objective of the U.S.? Is it to get the Russians out of Ukraine? Is it, you know, to get regime change in Moscow? Is it the permanent strategic defeat of Russia? You know, which is feasible to do, incredibly dangerous to my mind, because it'll bring another round in the war. And not just, you know, nuclear weapons, that's one form of escalation, but what if there's a national Putin goes for a national mobilization and other measures which I mentioned, imposes martial law, instead of having a special military operation, choosing instead total war. You know, that's quite conceivable that would happen. And part of that escalation might be nuclear weapons, but it would only be part of it. And this isn't just sort of something on the margins of possibility. It's something which is really quite likely and even probable if the war goes on.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. There's some relief this week in that Putin did not stress that in his victory speech. Actually talked about going on domestic life as usual, and with the idea that somehow this would not inconvenience the Russian population very much. But you do wonder how that could last. And, you know, the real issue now is with flooding weapons into the Ukraine from the West, whether by accident or intention, if those supply lines get attacked, you know, and certainly in one of the countries where that part of NATO that they're coming from, it's pretty difficult to see how it could stop. It's also difficult to see how you can reconcile the rhetoric on the Ukrainian side with the position of the Russians, because they're now saying they want to turn back to before 2014. They wouldn't even have the Russians stay in the Crimea, right?
Yeah, so that's part of the Ukrainian rhetoric. On the other hand, when there were peace talks, you know, they said, you know, they'd deal with Crimea, you know, in 20 years. And, you know, there seemed to be quite reasonable suggestions from the Ukraine side and from the Russian side. But it didn't, you know, then it seemed to evaporate. Now, it might be that this was all, to a degree, propagandistic, but these were quite, the Ukrainians at that point were not talking about going back to 2014, but going back to the 23rd of February this year. But that has sort of disappeared since. And, you know, there is another question, which I think one should touch on, Bob, which is, if people that, you know, that if Putin went or came under extreme pressure, this seems to be a sort of assumption that this would be towards making peace. But that isn't at all really what's most likely. There is some evidence that the institutions, the most powerful institutions that are now criticizing Putin within the Russian elite, are so parts of the FSB, of the security services and the military, but above all the security services, who thinks he's sort of only half fighting the war. You know, why doesn't he get on with it? Why doesn't he call a national mobilization? Why did he let conscripts go home? Why did he sort of continue to pretend this is just, you know, a special military operation? It's not going to, it's not going to make life more difficult for Russians. There's a sort of, there seems to be a growing a sort of total war element within the sort of powerful parts of the Russian elite. Very difficult to identify this, people who say this, how do they really know? This is, you know, deeply secretive system. Power is very concentrated on Putin himself. But these are quite sort of significant, I think, reports, I think, that part of the Russian state system thinks is not against the war, it's against Putin not waging the war effectively and not mobilizing Russian resources. That's another option that's going to come in. It's not going to be the progressive liberals who are going to overthrow him and declare peace.
Yeah, that is an incredibly important point, because after all, you and I were in the old Soviet Union under Gorbachev, and folks like us thought Gorbachev was a good choice. He was talking about genuine democracy and challenging power, perestroika, glasnost. He talked about all the distortions and so forth. That didn't play well in the old Soviet Union. And in fact, Gorbachev ended up being a person who was very unpopular. I think one poll he had like 1-3% support because he was giving away the store. And the irony is that Putin, Yeltsin was then the alternative when you and, later when I was there. And the what bailed Yeltsin out at the behest really of the United States and others was Putin, who at least didn't drink and seemed to be able to make the trains run on time and, would be pro-Western. And how this thing spun out of control is amazing to me, because Putin, after all, was the one who defeated the old communists. He defeated the old, people who thought you had to have more authoritarian power, that Gorbachev was weak. And he comes in, and now he's described everywhere as this Hitler figure. And you make a very important point. Why do we assume, that's always the assumption, that somehow liberal Democrats will emerge? And that doesn't happen very often. We just saw in the Philippines, we've been waiting for that a long time, and we got another Marcos back. Mm. So this is a historic trap, I would suggest. And also, let me ask you one other factor. To what degree There's the whole Russiagate Democratic Party concern that the Russians were siding with Trump and that domestic politics play into this. Because I feel there's a big irrational element here in the hostility to Putin in that respect. He hurt us. Now we're going to hurt him. And not sufficient worry to what comes after.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, there are two things. Since 2016, blaming it on the Russians, Hillary Clinton saying, didn't she say our big mistake was making an enemy, or what made her vulnerable was making an enemy of Vladimir Putin. The two things. First of all, it was kind of ridiculous. There was never the evidence for this. Ridiculous intelligence thing by the former British agent. You looked at it. This was complete rubbish.
The Steele memo.
The Steele memo, yeah. But suddenly this bit, things that nobody, no media outlet would run for months, and then suddenly as the whole sort of anti-Trump business ratcheted up, this was suddenly treated as if it was sort of holy writ or something. There was also, I think, a presumption that Russia was amazingly powerful, it could actually had the means and the, to determine or strongly influence the outcome of an American election. What's surprising, in Britain and in America is the way that this currency became, was accepted. Nonsense that it was. You just have to read any of the books about Hillary Clinton's campaign to discover why she, rather good reasons, why she lost it. You suddenly had people like Steele and who produced this memo being interviewed seriously by sort of mainline media in Britain, and in the US. So this was always not, but it created an atmosphere of hostility. And I think a sort of paranoia that somehow the Russians were far more powerful than they imagined. I think there were also, Russia, the regime, going in for these kind of infantile sort of gangsterish attacks on not very important exiles. Like the attempted poisoning of somebody in Salisbury in England, and stuff like this. That showed a sort of something that was both, aggressive, crude, and pretty dumb. But I think going back to your point, that a whole political atmosphere was created in which Russia was sort of assumed to be hostile, which might have been true, but far more powerful than it really was. And that sort of paranoia, never ended and, has been sort of taken another direction during the war in Ukraine. And again, there's a contradictory thing. On one hand, it's very clear the Russian armed forces are much weaker than people imagined in Ukraine. But at the same moment, people are saying, well, what if they attack Poland and, Eastern Europe, which is, they can barely mount an offensive in the far east of Ukraine. So I think that, it's this strange mixture of acting as if Russia was very weak, but somehow very strong at the same moment.
Well, it sort of goes back to your countryman Orwell in The Search for an Enemy. And we've been talking about that for a long time, giving first the old Soviet Union and then Russia its own Vietnam, a popular war that they're saddled with. We thought we did it in Afghanistan. But I wonder, maybe we could end this by thinking about what might be the ultimate goal. I think it's containing China. And you hear increasingly talk of that, and this agreement that Putin made with China, with the Chinese leader, at the time of the Olympics, must have been quite alarming. They both challenged American hegemony in a very fundamental way. And you hear a lot of talk about, the importance here is to send this big message to China. And I wonder if that is not driving the drama and why we need a humiliating defeat for Putin and a regime change. Anything less won't do. If he gets to hold on to Crimea, if he gets to survive, he gets to sell his oil, well, that won't do it. You got to, as I see it, the hawks that used to be the neoconservatives and they used to be in the Republican Party, they now are the Biden State Department and the same people who fomented a lot of this issue in the Ukraine. And it seems to me they have a larger picture, which is really that they're serious about American hegemony. This is a new Rome. This is no one else in the world, whether Russia or China, is going to make our life more difficult. And I think, you know, maybe I'm going too far here, but I think that's the ultimate game plan.
Yeah, I think I don't know how far it's a motive, but I'm sure it's a pretty significant motive. And it's perceived as that, so not so much in Europe, but it is not just in China, but in India and, you know, the Far East. They think what will be our status if there's just one single superpower? And you hear that not just, you know, from sort of radical folks, but you hear that from sort of, you know, Malaysian business tycoons and, you know, significant players in India, that there's this fear that, you know, Russia goes, that this is kind of a new sort of American, West European hegemony, which is going to affect them, and not just China, but all the other sort of powers, that sort of feeling that there was, you know, more room to maneuver in the last few years, but they can see that disappearing.
The plates have shifted. This is not the kumbaya moment of the UN, where we accept people with different political systems. This could be, if there's a humiliating defeat of Putin and he's taken away in handcuffs, this is the crowning day for the neoconservatives. This was their vision. This is what's supposed to happen. You can't trust the rest of the world to find its own path, and you have to step in and be the heavy, and it is a notion of the good Rome. And I think it's taken seriously. Now, Joe Biden actually seems to have some resistance to that, seems to be a bit more cautious because of his past experience. But then you hear the folks from the Pentagon and the State Department and the CIA, they're not talking about any hesitation. In fact, let me end on this. I never thought I would read a Thomas Friedman column that I really was cheering for, but he had one this morning. I guess it's Wednesday. No, it's still Tuesday in the New York Times, where he cautioned. He cautioned about going too far with this sort of America First example. And he brought up in particular the assassination of these 10 generals that the U.S. seemed to have something to do with, and the blowing up of their flagship, and you know, and that he said, you know, and they're boasting about it. And he said, wait a minute, this has real consequence. What are we talking about here? So do you want to take the last word on that?
Yeah, it goes back to what we were saying earlier, which was this amazing sort of self-confidence based on nothing, that this won't escalate into a much bigger war, which nuclear might be one part, but it wouldn't necessarily be the only part. You know, we could have a much bigger war without that. But the mostly people are extremely lackadaisical about this. And, you know, it just reminds me, you know, I was in Afghanistan 2001, two Americans came in, seemed frankly successful, same thing 2003 in Iraq. At one moment, you know, in Syria, all these other places, you know, where you had the same sort of self-confident rhetoric coming out of the security establishment in Washington. And, you know, and then things fell apart for them. You know, I can sort of sense the same sort of rather sort of mindless overconfidence again taking over. So I think that there's a sense that we have a total war already. We don't, you know, this could get an awful lot worse.
Let's take a minute to think about that, even short of nuclear war, which would be the end of humanity. Let's just be clear about that. But it could get very quickly a lot messier. And do you have the feeling, I mean, you're quite knowledgeable about all this. As you say, you've covered those other wars. You've seen them go south from their rosy expectations. What could happen here? Would it extend into Russia itself? Would the Russian military back Putin? Would they take on this Western force? Where would that leave China? What is your assessment of the risks here?
I think that, you know, it could go either way, but people underestimate the way that there are guys sitting, you know, in the Russian security forces and in the army thinking Putin doesn't know how to fight a war. What we need is somebody who knows how to fight, you know. And this could, this could get, the war could get an awful lot hotter. I think partly this sort of demonization of Putin, you know, brutal fellow, no doubt, but demonization is one of aspect of that things can get no worse, but actually they could, but you could have a leader who is rather better at fighting a war than Putin has turned out to be.
And what would that entail?
Well, it might include nuclear weapons. It might include sort of national mobilization. You know, they're really rather a small army, you know, that's been doing the fighting. Putin sent the conscripts home after a year, you know. People said, oh, but under Russian law, you couldn't keep them and send them into Ukraine. I think the kind of, you know, I don't think that in the Second World War, under Soviet leaders, you would have got away with that. So I think that, the chances of this, if there is a regime change in Russia, then it's like there's a very good chance it'll be a much tougher, more militaristic regime. Not one that's going to run up the white flag. I think that all the sort of the neocon attitude in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, just seem to think, you know, we win a victory, we run up the stars and stripes and that's it. But actually, as they discovered in both countries, worse things can happen and tougher guys can emerge, tougher enemies can emerge.
So you think nationalism and militarism remains a strong force in Russia after the Soviet Union, and this Victory Day rhetoric and the analogy with defeating the Germans, you think it resonates to some degree?
To some degree it does, you know, but it's, you know, they're conscious that things haven't worked out, you know, somebody who was at one of those Victory Day celebrations in Petersburg, so he was saying there used to be a million people out on the streets, now they're far less, you know. I think the people are conscious things are not going well. You know, do they have an appetite for a bigger war? Most of them probably absolutely don't want a bigger war. But maybe the guys, you know, in Russian security and elsewhere think differently. I'm not saying it's going to happen that way. It could fall out. You know, Russia simply, you know, agrees to a peace, you know, which is in which it, you know, which is pretty humiliating and so forth. But, you know, it seems to me that that's not very likely, that the Russians are likely to double down on trying to get a victory out of this, and not just Putin doubling down, but I think about Russia in general doubling down and trying to win a final victory.
Well, on that depressing note, because doubling down means doubling down on civilian deaths and casualties, and as well as that of conscripts and all that. But on the other hand, you bring a great deal of expertise. You've witnessed these wars. And so I want to thank you, Patrick Coburn, formerly of The Independent for many decades, now of the I publication. And that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW and the great staff there for posting these shows. Joshua Shear, our executive producer. Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who writes the introduction and edits it. Lucy Berber, who does the transcription. And the JKW Foundation for helping us with some financial support. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.